order.
An extraordinary week in the House, with most of it spent under urgency and 80% of the time devoted to passing one bill, intending to extend its power to create special housing areas due to expire before the end of the month and make a technical change clarifying a potential conflict between the Public Works Act and the Housing Act, the government piled both measures together into what's called an omnibus bill, which can contain several amendments to existing laws under the umbrella of a single broad policy. But that then opened the gate to opposition amendments relating to that same broad policy objective, and they had to be debated. In this way, the government lost control of the chamber time that its Housing Legislation Amendment Bill, having to rely instead on two of its usual allies, ACT and United Future, for a majority of one vote to keep the bill moving towards its final reading. That ended just before 11 on Wednesday night, after 18 hours of debate under urgency, which began after question time on Tuesday, with trouble right at the start, as Rhys Lyon explains.
The government's leader of the House had barely begun moving urgency before he was interrupted.
Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, I move that urgency be accorded the introduction and passing through all stages of the Housing Legislation Amendment Bill. Mr Speaker, this bill will allow the extension of special housing areas throughout the country.
Order. It is a very unusual, but on this occasion a point of order has been called. I will hear it.
New Zealand First's Denis O'Rourke complained that the bill didn't meet the standards of an omnibus bill, as outlined by the Standing Order 263A, requiring the two parts of the bill to be interrelated. The Speaker, David Carter, disagreed.
The bill does two things in order to increase the supply and the affordability of housing. Both relate to the stated purpose of increasing supply and affordability of land. It is in order and does comply with Standing Order 263A.
After passing its first and second readings on Tuesday, debate on parts 1 and 2 of the bill during its committee stage were completed late on Wednesday morning. That's when Labour's Phil Twyford put up a series of amendments, adding more parts that had to be debated.
Really pleased to see this new part 3.
So am I.
Sarah, I think there's no doubt this is going to significantly strengthen what is a flawed and disappointing bill based on the first two parts. But part three will really strengthen this bill. And it's quite consistent with the goal of this bill, which is housing affordability and particularly, in this case, an increase in the supply of housing. And, we made a number of criticisms in the first and second readings, especially when the Honourable Dr Nick Smith was in the chair, about the limitations of the government's policy of special housing areas. They've yielded very few new homes in the 3 years since the government legislated the Housing Accords and Special Housing Areas Act. We've seen in Auckland, I think, in 3 years, only 1,300 new homes have been built in the special housing areas. It's highly debatable how many of those would not have been built if the Act had never been passed in the first place. At best, we can say the special housing areas have perhaps brought forward some houses that would have been in the pipeline anyway. The other big defect, of course, in this whole policy approach is that it has resulted in very few affordable homes,
right,
which, after all, is what people are so desperate for. And we've seen in Auckland, Dr Smith was kind of pressured by Auckland Council and in this Parliament into allowing a requirement for 10% of the new dwellings in the special housing area in Auckland to be required to be affordable. But we know also that in other parts of New Zealand where he negotiated housing accords, he refused point blank to allow a requirement for a certain percentage of affordable homes. Now, the approach that we see set out in part three of this bill is a whole different approach to tackling this problem. And it recognises that we have currently a broken housing market. And in fact, yesterday, I think, Dr Smith, housing, building and housing minister, acknowledged to News Hub, I think it was, that he was willing to concede that the Auckland housing market is, and I quote, out of control. After 8 years in government and after 3.5 years as housing minister, he has acknowledged not that there's a housing crisis, but that the Auckland housing market is out of control. One of the ways it's out of control is that it's not delivering any affordable houses. Only about 5%, according to the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, only 5% of the new homes that are being built are affordable. Well, sir, part three of this bill, which I will dub the Kiwi Build part of this bill, would actually result in the construction of thousands and thousands of new, high-quality, affordable homes for first-home buyers. Because, sir, what this bill does is it amends the Housing Corporation Act and says that the Minister of Housing, for the moment, let's assume that's the Honourable Dr Nick Smith, must ensure that affordable housing is built, for the moment, that the Minister of Housing must prepare a plan in consultation with the corporation for the delivery of 10,000 affordable houses per year for first-home buyers. This is the first decent housing policy that we've been able to debate in this House for many a day, Mr Chairman. For years. For how many years?
8 years.
8 long years.
Labor's attempt to amend the bill attracted scorn from Housing Minister Nick Smith.
It is laughable, Mr Chairman. And what is so contradictory is when we had the first part of this bill that would actually have some land to build houses. Oh, no, 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 no. The Labor Party says you can't do that. All you got to do is magically pass this part and you'll get 100,000 homes built.
Just before 1 p.m. and while MPs were still debating Labor's amendment to the bill, the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, rose to his feet.
And that's why part three is necessary.
A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, Mr Chairman, in the spirit of generosity, I seek leave for there to be a question time at 2 p.m. today, notwithstanding urgency, and for there to be a third reading of the Housing Legislation Amendment Bill to be taken from 4 p.m. today, and at its conclusion, the House resume with government orders of the day.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard put it to the House.
Is there any objection to that suggestion? There is objection. Well, the House doesn't agree.
And Mr Mallard was back on his feet a few minutes later.
I should not have put that leave because it's only leave that could have been taken in the House and not in the committee. But time now is to have some kai. I will resume the committee at 2 o'clock.
Following the lunch break, there was further debate on Mr Twyford's amendment, which was eventually defeated by the government's majority, whereby MPs then turned to the next of Labor's proposed amendments, though National's Michael Woodhouse appealed to Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows to rule it out of scope of the bill.
And end the debate on it forthwith, on the basis that it is outside the scope of the bill. This is an amendment effectively to a tax measure, a revenue measure.
That, however, drew a quick response from an eagle-eyed Chief Labour Whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Chairman, the standing order that the Minister just quoted, 3023, refers to local and private bills. It does not apply to government bills.
After Mr Woodhouse clarified his point of order, the Deputy Speaker made his ruling.
I'm prepared to allow the debate to continue at the moment, rule it is in scope. But I can't see this debate on this part lasting very long at all.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows. And while debate on that part was over relatively quickly, further opposition amendments, all of which were defeated, took the bill's total number of parts to 8. The bill later passed its final reading by 61 votes to 60, just before 11 o'clock on Wednesday night. National supported by United Future and ACT to give the bill its one-vote majority.
Rhys Lyon, and he'll be back later in the program with his weekly report from the committee rooms. Back in the chamber, coming up to the regular adjournment time of 10 p.m. on Tuesday night, after more than 2 hours of debate on part one of the Housing Legislation Amendment Bill, Labor's Chief Whip, Chris Hipkins, had this question.
Mr Chairman, why are we here? Why are we here and what is this bill that we're debating? Well, the bill that we are debating extends the time frame for the special housing areas, and it extends the time frame in which they can be established until the 16th of September 2019. So why are we here doing this under urgency? Why is this so urgent that the entirety of Parliament has to grind to a halt to push this through under urgency? Was this unexpected? Was the minister who drafted the legislation in the first place, was he unaware when he wrote that those were actually going to be the dates in which the law expired and the dates in which further special housing areas weren't going to be able to be established? If so, why did it take until this week for him to bring something to the House to do something about that? Because actually a minister that was vaguely competent in administering the legislation that they themselves had written would have been able to anticipate that this was going to be an issue and would have been able to address that through the regular legislative process. So why are we here?
It's the all-time big question, but easily answered by an MP paid to be in the debating chamber on a Tuesday night, although on the other side of the chamber, Nationals Palmerston North MP, John O'Naylor, had a different point of view.
I move that the question be now put.
When a bill is being debated in its committee stage, the time spent on each part or clause is entirely in the hands of the committee chairman, in this case Assistant Speaker Lindsay Tish, who decided to give the call to Labour's David Cunliffe, who had a more complicated take on why they were there.
Thank you. I wish to make a reasonably technical contribution to this discussion, and specifically around Clause 5 of Part 1, which I don't believe has been addressed yet in the discussion. There are many, many clauses that we have not yet touched upon in this Part 1 debate. Sir, before I do, may I make a brief comment in respect of the previous exchange?
While Labour's David Cunliffe delved into the bill's entrails, the Greens' Catherine Delahunty looked outside the chamber.
I wonder how the people sitting in the motels who've been sent there by work and income because they've got nowhere to live, watching parliamentary television, because what else would you do? I wonder how those people feel listening to the technical and arcane debate when what they want is somewhere to live that they can afford. And I wonder how it feels for the people who testified at the Homeless Inquiry when they read Part 1 of this bill and look for the innovative, committed justice-based provisions that are going to provide them with a home. I wonder what they think of us, as they know we're going home to comfortable homes and they're going back to the car, the garage, all the transients of 22 different homes for a child in 3 years, and we call this a debate about housing? This isn't a debate about housing.
Whatever it was about, the debate resumed at 9 the next morning, and the vote on the first part of the bill saw ACT and United Future add their 2 votes to Nationals' 59, giving the government a total of 61 to defeat the 60 of the 3 main opposition parties, Labour, the Greens and New Zealand First, joined by the 2 Māori Party MPs who had crossed the floor to oppose the bill itself after voting with the government for urgency under their formal agreement to support National on procedural motions. But then it was the lone ACT Party MP David Seymour who stepped into the spotlight as Labour's housing spokesman Phil Twyford outlined his party's opposition to Part 2 and the effect on private property rights of the offer-back obligations to former owners of land taken under the Public Works Act for housing but not yet used for that purpose.
And I want to hear what David Seymour has to say about this bill. He is the self-appointed conscience of the nation's private property rights, but he's coming to this House to vote for this bill that confiscates people's private property rights without even the luxury of going off to a select committee so that this bill can be picked apart by expert opinion and public submission.
Responding to Phil Twyford, the ACT member for Epsom accepted that there was an ideological dilemma.
There is an inherent conflict between the Public Works Act and the Housing Act. There is a conflict in saying that the government has a role in developing and building housing on Crown land, and yet the government also has a requirement to give a first right of refusal to people who may have had their land taken compulsorily under the Public Works Act in the past. Mr Chair, that conflict does not sit easily with me because, unlike the Labor Party, I do not believe that the party, that the government, should be in the housing development business. There is no public policy justification for the government to be building houses.
Mr Seymour then explained how he was able to vote for the bill.
So what I have done is negotiated with the minister to support this bill on the basis that we will improve public policy in the long run.
Mr Seymour's initiative, limiting the amendment's life to 10 years, was adopted by the government, securing his vote, without which it would have lacked the numbers to get the bill passed. While that majority was just enough to keep the bill moving, its speed through the remaining stages slowed dramatically after the opposition moved amendments increasing the number of parts up for debate from 2 to 8 and attracting this response from the Minister of Building and Housing.
The Honourable Nick Smith.
Mr Chairman, I welcome the opportunity to debate part 3 that's been put forward by the Labor opposition on this bill, because it exposes for everybody to see what a bunch of flakes they are when it comes to housing policy. You see, what this bill says is that if we just simply pass a bill that says that 10,000 affordable houses will be built each year, whammo! Magically, it's going to happen! That's all you need to do!
Building and Housing Minister Nick Smith, whose housing legislation amendment bill passed after 18 hours of debate, while two other government bills, one establishing a register of sex offenders and the other introducing plain packaging for cigarettes and tobacco, passed their third and final readings in 3 hours on Thursday afternoon. Now to Rhys Lyon in the committee rooms.
On Thursday, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee met to hear submissions on the Maritime Crimes Amendment Bill, which sets new offences for terrorist acts committed at sea. The bulk of submissions expressed concern that the bill could see peaceful protesters charged as terrorists, as outlined by Feroz Brailsford.
Criminal acts are not terrorist acts, and I think this was addressed by the human rights lawyers. Very simply, fine. If you believe that someone should not have committed the act at sea, prosecute them, but don't chuck on the label of terrorism. It's just a way of trying to encourage people to stay away from peaceful civil disobedience and actually crush freedom of speech.
To make his point clear, Mr. Brailsford pointed to New Zealand's protesting history.
During the Springboks tour, people committed criminal offences, and my father was one of those people, so was my grandfather. And I think now, looking back, that is something that I am very proud of, that my family was there and was engaging in that kind of civil disobedience. And I think as a nation, we are proud, and we validate the actions of those protesters. In the same way, when it came time for our country to discuss the anti-nuclear position that we were in the end going to take, people engaged in protest on land and at sea, and again, they committed criminal offences. And again, we validate them today, proudly enshrining them as part of our national identity.
Mr. Brailsford said those types of acts should not be labelled as terrorism.
Types of acts that our nominee for the UN Secretary General actually helped orchestrate and mobilise during the times of the anti-nuclear protests. I don't think it does justice to her memory or the memory of my father or my grandfather to go and label their acts, if they were committed today, terrorism.
Feroz Brailsford. And another submission came from Law Society representative Jonathan Orpin.
The Society is pleased to appear in front of you today to make three relatively technical suggestions about the way that the legislation could be amended. I think I can be relatively brief. The points are set out in our written submission. The first suggestion is that the definition of terrorism in the bill be harmonised with the definition in the Terrorism Suppression Act. I've set out in paragraph 2.3 of the submission in bold the key differences between the two sections. The passage that's quoted there is from the Terrorism Suppression Act, and you'll note that there's an additional requirement in that Act that the conduct be carried out for the purpose of advancing an ideological, political or religious cause, which appears intended to draw the link to terrorism. And then also the compelling in the Terrorism Suppression Act is required to be unduly compelling or to force. And the Society suggests that harmonisation here is worthy of the consideration of the committee for two reasons, really. First, as a matter of good legislative drafting, the Society makes the point that unless there's a difference intended in the application of the Acts in terms of keeping the statute book in good order, it would be a good idea for the legislation and the language to reflect one another unless some difference is intended. And if a difference is intended, it might be helpful for this committee or members of the House to make that clear if it ever comes up later for the courts, why different language was chosen and what differences were intended. And the second point we make, and that's at 2.5 of the Society's submissions, is that the Terrorism Suppression Act appears to set a slightly higher threshold, which would appear in the Society's submission to be appropriate, particularly the use of that word unduly compelling, to again try and draw a distinction between legitimate acts at protest, which aren't intended to be captured, and terrorist acts. The second point that the Society makes is a suggestion that the bill be amended to include something like the peaceful protest clause in the Terrorism Suppression Act, which is in section 5, subsection 5 of that Act, which we've quoted at 3.1 of our submission. And members will see that it's not a complete carte blanche for peaceful protest being excluded. The language requires that, it says that for the avoidance of doubt, the fact that a person engages in any protest, advocacy or dissent, or engages in any strike, lockout or industrial action is not by itself a sufficient basis for inferring, and then that the person is carrying out an act with an intention or intends to cause an outcome. So it doesn't by itself mean that actions can never come within the scope of it, but it's saying that by itself engaging in those behaviours doesn't. And in the Society's submission, that strikes an appropriate balance. And what is a difficult area to legislatively draw the line between something which perhaps we instinctively all can recognise when we see it, but it is hard sometimes to put into words that distinction. The third submission we make is directed in particular to the proposed new section 4A, subsection 1, paragraph C, which relates to using a ship in a manner that causes death or serious injury or damage. The Society makes the point that although the opening words of the section require that any of the acts be done intentionally, the Act could be read, and I doubt this is the way it's intended by Parliament, but if that's right, it would be useful to clarify it, that only the use of the ship has to be intentional, and that the damage, death or serious injury doesn't have to be intentional as well. I suspect that Parliament and the committee intended that both be intentional, and if that's the case, the Society suggests it would be useful to clarify. If you look again, and this point isn't in the written submission, but if you look at the Terrorism Suppression Act, Section 5, subsection 2, it's very clear from there that the causes which are specified in that Act must be intended. The language is, an Act falls within this subsection if it is intended to cause, and then there's various other words, and then the Acts are listed. So that point's been clarified in the Terrorism Suppression Act, and it might be useful to do the same here. I can perhaps pick up on a point that I heard Mr. Bennett make to other speakers earlier about what the difference here might be in terms of a practical application. To give one example, if you had a protest series of flotilla of vessels out in a harbour, Auckland's been talked about a lot, protesting a visiting ship perhaps or some government facility. If, for example, you know, as in the cases protests we've seen in the past, there are lots of ships present, there might be manoeuvring by vessels in the flotilla, and the ship that's coming through, it's conceivable that an accident, a genuine accident, occurs. No one's ramming a vessel, but they're in close contact to try and make a point to wave banners, and someone dies either or is seriously injured either on one of the flotilla vessels who are protesting or on the visiting ship. That on its face would appear to come within the section, and again the Society doubts very much that that's the intention of Parliament, but it draws the matter to the committee's attention for its consideration.
That raised some questions from the National Party's David Bennett.
Yeah, look, I understand what you're saying, but you know, if you put your boat in a position where another boat can run into it, there's a definite intention. And so I disagree with you that you know that you're just all running around and it just sort of happens. It'd be like walking across the motorway. You know, you're putting yourself in that position, something's going to happen. So I think your intention is clear. And that's where I caution around your breaking the intention in your definition, because you may have an intention to put yourself in a place there, but that actually may lead to an intention to cause damage on the other side, and I don't think you can distinguish those two.
I appreciate the point you're making, and I think I would say two things in response. Firstly, there are obviously a range of circumstances, and there may be an example that falls within what you're saying, where you are so close that it's almost inevitable that there is going to be contact between vessels, and then perhaps you might say that the damage was intentional, although I think it would have to be pretty extreme in terms of how close the vessels were. But I would say that there are a range of other circumstances where you certainly couldn't go that far, but you might have someone captured. For example, the weather's pretty bad outside today, but if you had a visiting nuclear vessel, I'm sure that there would be people that were out there protesting, and even people that were using the best endeavours to maintain a safe distance but make their point at the same time, which is no doubt a difficult balance to strike. Accidents can happen at sea because it's an unpredictable environment. So there is the possibility that there are genuine accidents which aren't intended by people on either side, which as a result of the legislation result in people potentially being subject to prosecution for terrorist offences. Now, there are a range of offences under the Maritime Transport Act about safety, which people may be guilty of if they're not... if they end up in those situations because they haven't taken all reasonable steps to avoid them. But the society's submission will be those type of offences where the conduct that you're concerned about is really a lack of concern for safety should be dealt with under the Maritime Transport Act, which makes specific offences related to that type of conduct rather than being dealt with under this Act and labelled terrorist.
It's not a matter of safety, is it? Because that's not the issue. The thing is that this is a foreign power's vessel, you know, it's a military vessel. You know, you're getting in the way of it. So, you know, it is a terrorist act on a foreign country, isn't it?
Well, I can't speak for other submitters, and the society doesn't take a policy position about the merits of the issues that might be being subject to protest. But the point I agree with is that where there are safety offences or there is damage caused, there are a range of criminal offences that people could be charged with. And I doubt very much, to be fair, that people would be charged in the type of examples under this legislation, because I doubt that it's the intention of either the committee, Parliament, or the drafters of the 2005 protocols to capture this type of conduct. The point, at least as far as the Law Society is making, is if that's the case, good legislative drafting would be to spell out what is and isn't intended, and these amendments are, from our perspective, reasonably technical, but are just intended to draw the distinction between the different types of conduct.
Law Society representative Jonathan Orpin with that submission on the Maritime Crimes Amendment Bill to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, which is due to report it back to the House by January the 5th next year. In total, there were 17 committee meetings held during the week, with the list of meetings rescheduled 5 times due to urgency, including submissions on Marianne Street's petition on assisted dying, which were postponed because the Health Committee hadn't sought leave to meet during urgency. Those submissions are now due to be held next Wednesday.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Now to the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, for a look at the week ahead.
Mr. Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 13th of September, the Government will look to complete the first reading of the Education Update Amendment Bill and the Enhanced Identity Verification and Border Processing Legislation Bill, and to progress a number of other bills on the order paper.
No mention of a Members' Day on Wednesday, another casualty of urgency, which also prompted this question from Mr. Brownlee from Labor's Shadow Leader of the House, Chris Hipkins.
I wonder if the Leader of the House can indicate whether the Government intends to make further progress on any of the other omnibus bills on the order paper, and if so, would he be willing to indicate which one so that we can get the amendments drafted up in advance?
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
It's an interesting question. Quite clearly, the Government is here to advance the interests of the nation. The opposition are here simply to amuse themselves.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, getting the last laugh. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.